Hey, I'm Antonio Grisefo, and this is the Brooklyn Monk in Asia Podcast, Episode 14, An Anti-Travel Story, Part 1. When you go looking for a book publisher, the first thing you have to decide is what categories you're writing. When I first started out, and the editors asked me for my category, I said, I don't know, my stories are a bunch of funny stuff that happened to me in Asia. Ah, said the editor, so you're a travel writer then. I really hate to be pigeonholed as anything. First off, I don't travel. I live in other countries and move about once or twice a year. But I don't like travel. If they'd been willing to bring the Shaolin Temple to Brooklyn, I never would have left in the first place. Stupid Shaolin Temple. In fact, if I lived in Florida and could visit Epcot Center whenever I wanted to, I wouldn't feel the need to visit a foreign country. But who could afford to go to Epcot Center all the time? I could spend months in Southeast Asia for what it costs to park your car there for one day. So, I went to Asia. As proof of my assertion that I don't travel, I've been to about 20 countries, but I've lived in 14 of them. And you know why I got an apartment and a job when I arrived in most of those countries? Because I hate traveling so much, I couldn't bear the thought of getting back on a bus or an airplane and leaving. So I stayed till I absolutely couldn't take it anymore, or until I got an offer for interesting work somewhere else. Then I moved on. So I never wanted to be a travel writer. I wanted to be a guy that wrote about a bunch of funny stuff that happened to him in Asia. But they don't have a category like that. So they made me say I was a travel writer. Then my books or articles would go to the travel editor's desk. Inevitably, after reviewing one of my manuscripts, the publisher would always complain, "This isn't travel writing." After reading it, no one would ever want to travel to any of the places you've visited. The first time I heard that, my heart soared. Finally, someone understands me. I hate travel. It's nasty, dirty, expensive, and uncomfortable. Sometimes the internet sucks, or the cable TV, and you can't always get good cell phone reception. But I know of a place which has all my favorite DVDs and a refrigerator stocked with foods that I like to eat. It's close to my work and all my friends. You know where? My house! That's right. You bought or rented your house because you liked it. So, why do you want to spend money to go sleep somewhere else? If you hate your house that much, just move. The first time I received a letter from a publisher saying that my stories discouraged travel, I thought, I found my career. I'd read stories by other authors saying how hard it had been to make it, or to even break into the industry. But here I was, my first time out, and I already found an understanding editor. Then I read the bottom of the letter, and it turned out that they were rejecting me. "This is not travel writing," they would conclude, or, "You should get out of travel writing and do something else if you hate it so much." First off, I never claimed to be a travel writer. They forced me to be a travel writer. Second, I don't hate writing. I love writing. There is nothing I want to do on this earth more than write a bunch of funny stories about stuff that happened to me in Asia. So where could I publish it? And that's been the issue right along. My first book, The Monk from Brooklyn, received 3,000 rejections before finally getting published by a small publisher. If you do a quick Google search, you'll find out there aren't 3,000 publishers and agents in the United States, which means I got rejected by some of them several times. One of the main problems I faced in each of these rejections is that none of the publishers had a category called a bunch of funny stuff that happened to me in Asia. So instead, they stuck me in travel and were unhappy with the results. Occasionally, they'd try and throw some work my way, so they'd ask me to write helpful hints for travelers, and this was one of my prized gems that got rejected. When I travel, I always go on the upper level of the bridge. This way, if it collapses, I land on the people underneath. Probably, it doesn't matter, because we all fall in the river and die. But it's a chance. Yeah, that one got rejected. Well, they say that Stephen King actually invented horror as a book genre. It didn't exist before him. So, I'm going to invent my own category and call it anti-travel. Anti-travel writing. And I'll proclaim myself as the best in that category. Now, travel has been around a lot longer than travel writing. The Vikings were some of the earliest travelers. Now, what we know about them is they never bathed and they invented non-consensual sex. So, this doesn't give travel a lot of gloss. In the first several years of being forced to make a living as a travel writer, I intentionally went to dangerous or uncomfortable places so I could write about them. I spent a lot of those early years in the jungles and mountains or sleeping out in the desert without a tent. One of the adventure trips I went on for a story was a survival trip in the mountains of Taiwan. It made me think back on all the Bear Grylls Man vs. Wild episodes I saw on Discovery Channel. In many of his shows, he had to drink his own urine to survive. This caused me to regret drinking so much coffee. Drinking my urine would just keep you up all night. Plus, it would give you coffee breath. They say that people who carry a gun or other weapon for self-defense are sometimes tempted to create a bad situation to try out their new toy. A minor argument over a parking spot suddenly becomes an act of self-defense, and someone winds up with a face full of pepper spray. Which for me is what a lot of my dating experiences have been like. So much so that that burning, tearing sensation of tear gas just makes me slightly aroused. But totally normal sexual behavior aside, I think the same is true for people who hoard up on survival rations and those aluminum survival blankets that look like they were borrowed from the set of the TV show Lost in Space. Those people can't wait for the world to end so they can show that all the money and time they spent on surviving was worth it. Every time their neighbors or other sane people laughed at them for farming mung beans on a wet napkin under the couch or installing TiVo in their bomb shelter, the hardcore survivalist tucks that insult away. It becomes another asbestos brick in their carbon graphite resolve to survive. Behind those camouflage faces and razor-sharp Rambo knives, believe it or not, there is a tortured soul thinking, yeah, laugh at me now. But when the apocalypse comes, and you're knocking on my bomb shelter, who'll be laughing then? And just like the people too quick on the trigger with the mace can when a blind date goes bad, the survivalist is so keen on surviving, every time the power goes out, they hustle their family into the basement and draw straws to see who gets eaten first. Now don't get me wrong, I can be hardcore when I need to be, but given a choice, I prefer to stay in a hotel. When I was a merchant seaman, I was a qualified lifeboat captain. I handpicked the 12 guys for my lifeboat. Most lifeboat captains wanted 12 strong guys who could row well, but I figured they'd be too stringy. Instead, I chose 11 strong, fit guys and one big fat guy named Arnold. This way, if we got stuck in that lifeboat till the rations ran out, we could survive by eating Arnold. And because of his tremendous size, it would be weeks till I had to make the agonizing decision of who to eat next. Jason Perkins. That bastard always cheated at cards. The guys used to complain because I wouldn't let Arnold row. In fact, I didn't even give him an oar. I didn't want him to toughen up or lose weight. While the other sailors were busy rowing, I just stood behind Arnold dripping butter on his back, salivating. But like a Thanksgiving turkey, he had a sixth sense that told him he wasn't going to make it. When we were fighting a headwind, or the current was going against us, the guys would start grumbling about, it would be a lot easier if Arnold helped us row. You'll thank me later when your belly is full, I told them. Especially you, Jason Perkins. You should be glad that Arnold is a beloved member of our team. It buys you a lot of time. But again, that was a lifeboat, a real emergency situation. Hobby survivalists, on the other hand, they go out and slaughter wheat and make their own bread out of paint chips on a sunny Wednesday afternoon when there isn't a care in the world. Those people are plain weird. They try not to use electricity or machines. They're like Amish, but carrying assault rifles. I think watching Bear Grylls show too much will also make you anxious for a life or death emergency, and you'll just create one. In my case, I was armed with the notion that the way to overcome a crisis was to drink your own urine. So at every turn, at every bump in the road, I asked myself, should I drink my urine now? Is it time? Struggling writers are a cliche, but struggling adventure writers are just plain pathetic. You talk about the ultimate sellout. I used to look in the mirror and see that mirror me was clearly judging real me. Then real me began to resent mirror me. The resentment seemed to be mutual. Eventually, it grew into hatred. But there was still that hint of attraction. It made shaving very awkward. Nowadays, I don't do that much adventure stuff, but I'm forced to endure travel from time to time, and I don't know why anyone would want to do this voluntarily. Because I'm dirt poor, I'm always traveling on the cheapest tickets from the worst airlines ever. I was trying to leave Malaysia and get back to my apartment in Bangkok, but the guy at the checkout counter told me, "I'm sorry, sir, but your luggage is overweight by 15 kilos. 15 kilos overweight? Are you telling me I have 30 kilos of gear? No, sir. I'm telling you that you have 15 kilos of luggages. So how could I be 15 kilos over? For departure from Malaysia, there is a zero luggage allowance. This is the return part of a round-trip ticket," I explained. "I came into Malaysia with 15 kilos of luggage. I think it's reasonable that I'll be leaving Malaysia with 15 kilos of luggage." "I'm sorry, sir. The luggage allowance for your departure of Malaysia is only being 0 kilos. If you exceed that amount, you must be paying a summons." "Why do you even have such a rule?" I asked. "Is it because you have a lot of people who leave all their luggage behind and then demand a discount?" In the end, I had to go pay the fine. But it had to be paid in Malaysian ringgit. And of course, I'd already converted all my money to Thai baht. So I had to leave the check-in area dragging 30 kilos of luggage. Yes, I know it was 15 kilos. But believing there was a zero luggage allowance was too much for me to accept. So I pretended it was a 15 kilo allowance and I was over by 15. "I really gotta pack lighter next time," I chastised myself. So I had to go change my Thai baht back into Malaysian ringgits, then go pay the fee. It was a disaster, and it made me wonder, why do people do this? And of course, the editors wouldn't let me include that little anecdote in the Welcome to Malaysia piece I was writing for an in-flight magazine. After 4 months of working in Hanoi, I was leaving, moving to Saigon. I was flying on a cheap flight, as usual, so I knew enough to buy extra luggage allowance in advance. I paid for 6 extra kilos. When I got to the airport, the woman at the check-in said to me, "You overweight." I honestly thought she was trying to insult me. "You're ugly," I retorted. It was an early morning flight. I hadn't had my breakfast or any coffee yet, and the taxi I had prearranged simply didn't show up. So I was running 30 minutes behind schedule, and very annoyed already. Then this total stranger tells me I'm fat. "I can lose weight, but you'll still be ugly," I told her for good measure. "You overweight. You baggage. 10 kilos overweight." A split second of relief washed over me as I kidded myself into believing that I wasn't fat. But then, the reality intruded upon my delusion. My luggage is overweight? You have to be kidding me. I paid for 6 extra kilos. Are you telling me that my luggage is a total of 16 kilos over? That's insane. "Yes, 10 kilo over," answered the woman, who wasn't as ugly as she had been when she called me fat. "How much is the overage per kilo?"
$6 per kilo," she said.
Now I exploded. $6 per kilo, 10 kilos, $60. I already paid almost as much for the low-cost carrier as I would for a real carrier. Now you want an additional $60? No way. My father's voice was ringing in my mind in that "I told you so" voice that I hated from my childhood. "What do you think? You won the lottery when you get a cheap ticket? I'll tell you what you get. You get crap. Simple mathematics. You take crap, discount it by a couple of bucks, and it's still crap. But morons like you believe the ad. You buy the ticket, and then everything's extra. You gotta pay for, what do you gotta pay for? You gotta pay for your meals? A newspaper? What do you think? They just give you a newspaper on the flight? Oh no, that would be like 20 cents. How could you expect Joe Schmo Airlines to fork over 20 cents? Yeah, you're so smart, you go to college. You trust them to maintain a large machine, weighing tons, costing millions of dollars, to carry you and 187 of your friends to fly in the sky, but they can't afford 20 cents for a newspaper? Madonna, that flight's coming down. And when it does, I'm going to laugh. You saved money. Besides, if they gave you a newspaper, they worry you wouldn't buy the toilet paper they sell on board for 20 bucks. I hate to admit it, but the ghost of my pop was right. With meals, the newspaper, and the luggage, I could have flown on Air France for like $5 more at this point. "I won't pay it," I shouted, but I don't know if I was talking to the ugly lady at the airline counter or my dad.
You will not flying to Saigon?" she asked.
"No, I am flying to Saigon, but I am not paying an additional $60.
"You leave luggage here?" she asked.
Will our hero make it? Will he get on the flight? Will he have to pay? You always pay. It seems like in life, nothing's free. There's always something where somebody's got to have their hand out and they want the money. Like my Uncle Nushik used to say, it's the money. The problem's the money. It's the money. You have the money, somebody wants the money. They take the money. They have their hand out. They want the money. Well, will Antonio pay? Will he get arrested? Will he board that plane? To find out, you'll have to tune in next time to the Brooklyn Monk in Asia podcast, episode 15, an anti-travel story, part 2. Coming soon to a podcast network near you. Warrior Odyssey, my book, a chronology of my adventures the first 6 or 8 years that I was in Asia, going from country to country studying martial arts. That book is now available on Amazon.com and on SpeakingAdventure.com. It's a good read. Check it out. Also, Martial Arts Odyssey, my web TV show, there's a Martial Arts Odyssey Volume 1 DVD, which is awesome. It's nothing like what's on the web for free. It's got interviews, it's got professional editing, it's got behind the scenes, it's got some talking, it's got some narration, it's got some artwork. It's really an awesome DVD, and you can get that from Lulu.com or from SpeakingAdventure.com. I got to get through all these announcements, but man, I am just overburdened by my financial issues. I don't even have 2 pennies to rub together. Now, part of that is because in Vietnam, they don't use pennies. But if they did, I wouldn't have 2 of them. I'd be lucky to have 1 of them. When I was a kid, whenever I asked my dad for money, I'd be like, Daddy, can I have 50 cents to go to the movies? 50 cents? When do you get a job? Because I'm 12 years old? When I was 12, I had a job. I worked in a coal mine. You were a coal miner, Daddy? Shut your mouth, you wise ass. I wasn't a coal miner. I was a shovel. I worked hard all day, 18 hours, sometimes 27 hours in a single day. I earned 3 cents a month, and I gave it all to my mother. So, I guess I'm not getting the 50 cents? Anyway, as an adult, I still feel like that. What am I going to do? You got to go out there and buy my books and DVDs. Or, I got it. When I was a kid, I used to go to Atlantic City with my grandma on holiday. And there were people that would sit on the boardwalk and make money doing caricatures, drawing caricatures of all the guests, all the holiday makers when they came by. And so I'm thinking, I don't draw very good, right? But I can write. So, here's the deal. I will come to your house. You'll feed me, obviously, put me up in a hotel, pay my plane and all that. And pay me to go to your house and then I will write a caricature of you. That's what I'll do. I'll write a very satirical caricature of you. It'll be like the Dean Martin celebrity roasts, but it'll just be me, like, hurling insults at you. And, I don't know, we could do that for, like, 50 bucks, 100 bucks, 5,000 bucks. I don't know. We'll negotiate something, but it's got to be paid in U.S. dollars. Or you go to my website, www.speakingadventure.com, and donate to the Keep Antonio Writing and Filming Fund. You can follow me on Twitter for free, Brooklyn Monk. You can watch all my videos for free on my YouTube channel, Brooklyn Monk 1. And you can join my Facebook fan page called Brooklyn Monk. There are so many ways to keep up with me. You know, I'm lonely. I just want people following me, listening to me. Listen to me. Don't ignore me. Please, come join me. And whatever you do, don't forget, please subscribe to this podcast and send copies of it to like 1,000 of your friends because, you know, we want them to join too. But you know what? Whatever you do in this life, you do what you want to do. You be an individual. Don't let anybody else tell you what to do or who to be. You be you. And I'll be me, Antonio Grisefo, a Brooklyn Monk in Asia, reminding you to go out and do something stupid today.